Kim Hook-Sim Kim is coming from the USDA ARS and was going to be and is giving a presentation on gene flow markers among European corn borer populations using microsatellites.
Thank you. Kyung Suk was looking forward to giving this talk, but he's a postdoc in my lab. He got an interview at a university, which is a pretty good excuse. So I'm happy to do this in his place. So in our laboratory, we study European corn borer dispersal, among other things, and the context of this recently has been for IRM and BT corn, or insect resistance management. And that strategy of IRM involves a high dose refuge, arrangement of fields, and monitoring for resistance for development. And then once that is detected, then steps for mitigation are put in place to try to drive the resistance allele frequency back down. This is a map of BT adoption, BT corn adoption against European corn borer. And the areas circled in black and red have been chosen by the registrant to be the areas where monitoring for resistance development takes place. But there's a problem in that we don't really know the correct spatial scale to be doing monitoring at. You don't want the locations too close together because it's a very expensive process, but if they're too far apart, then resistance could develop. And it wouldn't be detected until it had spread and it was too late to try to mitigate it. So we don't know the appropriate spatial scale, and the reason we don't know the appropriate scale is because we don't know the geographic dimensions of a corn borer population in terms of gene flow. So that's what we're trying to address. So we were trying to get answers to these questions, which are all interrelated. So what geographic scale does random mating occur in a population? What's the extent of gene flow, both spatially and temporally? And from that, we can calculate the spatial dimensions of the population. We can get indirect estimates of gene flow based on this parameter FST, which is a measure of genetic differentiation. It can theoretically range from 0 to 1. The higher the FST, the more different the populations are from one another. FST is useful for a number of things. One is that we can calculate migration rate between two populations directly from FST. So if you have two populations separated in space, they will genetically drift apart over time by chance events. And what keeps them homogeneous, or what acts in counter to that drift, is any migration or movement between the populations. So it's that relationship then that we can use to calculate migration or number of migrants per generation for any given population. And these estimates reflect the movement of genes among populations. So for determining the geographic size of a population, we have to deal with the fact that in the Midwest, it's a continuous distribution of corn borers. There's no real effective barriers to movement. Corn is everywhere, and so it's a giant metapopulation. But that makes Sewell Wright's concept of a neighborhood applicable. So in this equation, V is the parameter we're trying to figure out. It's the one-dimensional parent offspring distance. So a parent lays its egg. Here the larvae develop, and that offspring flies somewhere and lays its egg. So it's that distance that we want to calculate. D is the effective density of individuals. We can calculate that based on sampling of adults in Iowa. And so what we need then finally to solve for that V, which is what we're after, is an estimate of the effective population size. And that's also related to FST. So if you plot some measure of genetic distance on the y-axis versus geographic distance between the populations, then you get this isolation by distance curve. If there's some gene flow, but it's not free gene flow, there's some restriction, and so the reciprocal of the slope of that regression line is an estimate of the effective population size. So in the literature, there's some estimates of how far European corn borers move. In general, these kinds of estimates for mark recapture, range expansion data, and so forth, pretty much in agreement that it's around 50 to 80 kilometers per year max. On the other hand, there has been some genetic information or studies done. They're in the literature, and they all show very low FSTs, which is an indication of high gene flow. So which is it? What we're trying to do is, what we try to do then is use microsatellite markers to get estimates of FST. We did very extensive systematic sampling along two transects. These transects are each 720 kilometers or 450 miles long. The traps samples were taken at 50-mile intervals along these transects. And then I was a little bit worried that maybe 50-mile intervals were too big, and that there would be we wouldn't see any gene flow at those distances. So we had two areas in between with shorter intervals of 10 miles to address that possibility. So I'm going to show you preliminary data from these locations using four microsatellite loci. We have five more that we're getting genotypes for, and we'll add it to this analysis. It probably won't change the results much, if any, but it will make them more precise. And what we saw was at this scale, 450 miles, 720 kilometers, there's no significant FSTs between any population pairs. The pairwise gene flow, the lowest value calculated was 10, an exchange of 10 migrants per generation, which is very high. And a structure analysis indicated a single panmictic population at this scale of 450 miles. Because of that, there is no isolation by distance relationship that's significant. It's a flat line. So this isolation by distance, the top graph is what we expected to see. If you don't see that and you have a flat line like we had in our case, either if you have high FSTs but a flat line, that's an indication that the scale of sampling was too big, that there was no gene flow between the samples. But in our case, we had low FSTs and a flat line. And usually what that means is that there's widespread gene flow over the scale of the sampling. It's complicated in our case because this is an invasive insect that invaded from eastern U.S. through the Midwest, and so it could also be an artifact of range expansion. That range expansion reached Iowa back in the 1940s, so they've had close to 100 generations since then, so it seemed unlikely. On the other hand, the widespread gene flow didn't seem that likely either. So we're addressing it, trying to figure this out in a couple of ways. First, as we increased our spatial scale of sampling this last summer, and we're processing those samples now, it looks like we will see some significant FSTs. They will be still low. We wanted to get this isolation by distance line to calculate the effective population size, but we may or may not be able to do that for the reasons you've just seen. But there is another way to go about this, and that's a temporal analysis of gene flow. So that's looking at changes in allele frequency, changes in gene frequency at a particular spot over generations. So we've got samples like this in several places. I'll show you data from four along these transects from three different generations. And from the way this works, it will calculate both effective population size and migration rate. So for this particular population, we have an M of 0.07, which means 7% of the individuals in this population are probably migrants from one of these three, which are pooled. You can do this for the other populations. This one, the migration rate is very high. 86% of those individuals probably came from somewhere south. These distances are 100 miles or more along there, 150 miles to the south. very high migration rate for that one, 26% for that one. And the other point about this is that we also get these estimates of effective population size. So now we can estimate the size of the geographic size of these populations. So the conclusions from what we've seen is that this isn't an artifact of the range expansion. It's probably true that there is extensive gene flow over very long distances, at least out to 720 kilometers. Spatial dimensions occupied by a population appear to be very large. And there are some implications then for IRM. The assumption of random mating is probably easily met. There's so much movement. Resistance to BT corn will probably be slow to develop at the local scale, but on the other hand, once it does develop, it will spread very quickly, and probably so far and so fast that mitigation won't be really a realistic option. And so the other thing is that these sites for monitoring for resistance development can be widely separated without a problem. So with that, I'll end, but I do want to mention Chung Suk Kim, who's the postdoc who did most of this work, Nick Miller, who has also helped. He's a postdoc as well. So thank you.
We have time for maybe one question.
Yes.
About whether organ phosphates are being sprayed also in this region as organ phosphate could trigger hyperactivity at sublingual dosages before the moth dies, so they could help the population spread out.
The organophosphates,
yes.
Do what?
To cause hyperactivity to adults at sublingual dosages.
Oh.
So they may cause the adults to spread out. And I just wonder whether they spray organophosphates in this region.
There's very little conventional spraying for corn borers themselves in the U.S. because it's so hard to get the timing right. There are sprays for rootworms in the western part of the corn belt. I wasn't aware about the sublethal dosage causing increased movement, so maybe in that part of the range it could play a factor. But in combination with what the French are seeing, where there was no range expansion in any recent memory, They also see this situation of high movement, so I'm starting to believe that it must be real and intrinsic to the insect.
Thank you.